Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 99, Interview with John Boccaccio. All right, let's get this party started.
Well, we finally made it happen, Sean.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
If you want to know how to be discovered in today's industry, then you need to talk with people who have actually been discovered in today's industry.
Doing this, we're going to be undercutting the noble calling of writer and generating instead pixel-stained techno-peasant wretches.
You should never start a creative endeavor that you're not a little bit worried this might be impossible.
You can be an ongoing source of inspiration and a continuing challenge.
And welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. I am your host, Sean, and I am very happy to be with you today, especially since my life flashed before my eyes yesterday. For those of you who know me really well, you know that I work right now as a driver for Toyota. So, you know, it kind of takes me all over Northern California, switching cars between different dealerships or delivering cars to customers who bought a vehicle online, which is kind of crazy to me to buy a car never having seen it in person, but... people do it. The longest I've ever gone was about 300 miles one way. That was up to almost to, where was it? Eureka, I think. No, it wasn't Eureka. Well, wherever it was really far. But yesterday, I'm on 99 North heading out of Sacramento. And I need to do some research into this because it was extremely odd. But I'm going along and all of a sudden, there's a 737 coming down right on top of me. My heart jumped into my throat. My whole, you know, life flashed before my eyes. Obscenities fly out of my mouth. And it looked like this thing was crashing. It was going to come down right on the freeway. And of course, it was either going to hit me or I was barely going to get under it. Well, it goes overhead, just a few feet over the freeway. And I throw a look over my shoulder. All the cars around me are hitting their brakes. And it lands in a field, and I think there was a strip there. It was really hard to tell because all the weeds were grown in and there are bushes and everything, and I know they do crop dusting out there, but there definitely was not an airport made for a 737 out there. I think I would have seen the tower, some buildings, I don't know, some stinking planes maybe, but I couldn't see anything. It just looked like a field that this plane landed in. Very weird, I thought. I can't imagine that's normal, that they would build a landing strip for planes that big directly next to a freeway. I could be wrong, but it really, it scared the crap out of me. It's what it did. And it made me feel grateful for everything in my life. So, so I'm very happy to be doing this show today, this morning. Today I'm joined by John Boccaccio, who is a wonderful illustrator. He has done many, many book covers, been nominated for countless awards, and on top of it all, he's a really nice guy. So if you collect science fiction and fantasy books, I guarantee you, you have something on your shelf that he illustrated. And we have a great talk. We talked on the dealer floor, the dealer room floor of Comic-Con. I think I say the showroom floor, but we were in the dealer's room. And got interrupted once or twice, but that was totally cool. I think I mentioned last time China Mieville came over to get John to sign something for him. Dave Seeley was there. He was another great artist. Saw a couple other folks while we were doing the interview. So it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it very much. And I really enjoyed John's work. I have some of it hanging up in my house. So it's a great interview. We talk about the genre, talk about his process, how he approaches a book cover. And we have a really interesting discussion on the difference he sees between an artist and an illustrator, which I found to be a very fascinating conversation. So I think you'll enjoy this. And thank you, John, again for making time to let me into your booth at Comic-Con. But first, this episode is brought to you once again by Locus Magazine. Locus Magazine, covering the science fiction and fantasy industry for many, many decades. They really are simply one of the best magazines around. And I was happy that one of the listeners wrote in to say that he renewed his subscription because of the fond memories he had of having Logos first off, but then being reminded of it because of this podcast. So that was excellent. But if you want to know what's going on in this field, Logos Magazine is a good place to go. They have dozens and dozens of reviews in every issue, book reviews, magazine reviews. They let you know exactly what's going on. They have all the news and notes, upcoming books, new deals, books that have been delivered to the publishers, kind of inside bits that are happening in the business, coverage of conventions, you name it, it's in there. So Logos Magazine is where you want to go to be in the know. Check it out, adventuresinscifipublishing.com. Click on the little Logos image that you see there on the website, and it will take you right to LogosMag.com, and you can learn more about them right there. And please, when you order your subscription, let them know that Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing sent you. That would be awesome. Very, very helpful. Logos Magazine. I want to apologize for forgetting to put the harsh language warning up in last episode with Paula Bacigalupi. I meant to do that because I knew there was harsh language in the interview, and I just spaced. And, you know, I got some feedback about that, and I really appreciate everyone who wrote in. And I thought about it, and I decided, you know, from now on, there's really no need to have the language in there at all. We've almost done 100 shows here. Well, technically, we've done more than 100. And I've never censored anyone. I've never had to cut out language. And really, I haven't done that because it's happened so infrequently. It just so happens we've had a kind of an increase in some harsh language lately. I'm not really sure why. I think it's just coincidence. And I haven't been doing anything about it except giving some warnings. And I think I've forgotten twice now to do that. So I've just decided I'm going to go ahead and bleep those words out. It won't be changing anything the authors say. You'll still know what they said. You just won't hear the word itself. I do want the show to be something that's accessible to children. There's a big YA audience out there, and I think the podcast could play a role with some of those young ones who are soon to be adults. And you know, if my kid was 11 or 12, would I want them listening to something if I couldn't trust the rating of it? Probably not. I mean, I know they're going to hear that stuff, but that doesn't mean that they have to go out of their way to download it and put it in their brains. So I'm going to edit that out from now on, and I hope that will work for everyone. And thank you again for those of you who wrote in to talk to me about it. I really do appreciate your feedback. Let's go ahead and get to the interview with John. I'm going to come back afterward and tell you about M.K. Hobson's Part 3 of Historical Fantasy, which we have up on the website now, and tell you about some books that came into the studio. There's some really good things coming out, and I would like to share a few of them with you. So sit tight, relax, and we'll be back with John Picchio.
Irish drinking songs, Scottish bagpipes, totally trad, jigs and reels, Celtic rock. If it's independent Celtic music, you can find it on Mark Gunn's Irish and Celtic Music Podcast at CelticMusicPodcast.com.
We are now joined live on the Comic Con showroom floor, and it's crazy in here, by John Picchio, one of my favorite artists out there, World Fantasy Award winner and Hugo Award nominated artist, who's created the cover arts for books like Fast Forward 2, The Age of Misrule, The Metatemporal Detective, and many, 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 many more. So welcome to the show, Sean.
Nice to be here. I've heard a lot about the show, and I'm kind of glad to be on finally.
I think I just called you Sean. I think I need more coffee. But anyway, first off, I wanted to say congratulations on the big girl. And is this your first child?
First child. Came into the world on an express train. We weren't expecting her this early, but she's here, and we couldn't be prouder. She's quite the little fighter. Her name is Samantha Kate. The world has changed.
How has having a child affected your work, affected how you approach your work? I know it certainly affected the way I approached my writing when I had my first child.
Well, she's only been around for, I guess, 2 weeks and 3 days at this point. She's certainly, I think she was affecting me before she was even here officially. But I think I was already thinking of where I'm going after this sort of stage of my career, which I think I wonder sometimes if I'm going to get to do book covers for the rest of my life. I wonder if this stuff, especially as ebooks come in, is going to be changing form and changing market in a way that I'm going to have to rethink how much weight I put on book covers to make a living. Right now, it's pretty much all of what I do, and I make a decent living at it, and I work full time, and I really love this life. But I'd already been thinking about, well, what other things are you going to do just in case book covers start to change form in a way that you can no longer carry this kind of a life? And I've started to think, well, if you add on to that, now that I'm thinking about my daughter, what kinds of things would I like to pass on to her? So will my work take the form of illustrated books that I write and draw, maybe that I collaborate with other writers on? I'm starting to think of other forms in a way because of her. So we'll see where it goes. I haven't made decisions yet. And I think some things like the George R. R. Martin calendar that I'm working on right now for 2012, I think those things have to sort of play themselves out, and maybe some doors open that I can't even see right now. But I'm kind of excited. But she's definitely prompted questions in my head that might not have been there last year.
Interesting. I've had that experience too. It's amazing how in just a few days you start to see the world in a completely different fashion, you know. But going back to this idea that the book covers may, I don't know, start to dry up a little bit. Are you thinking about that just because of the ebooks starting to become a little bit more popular as the platforms get better, and you think that there may not be a place for the cover art anymore?
If I had to nail down why I'm concerned, it's because I don't know what the price point in the end is going to be for these things. And I think as the price point defines itself, that's how I'll be able to start to make decisions about where I think things are going to go. In other words, if people continue to sort of talk publishers down on the price of these things, I think that they're going to start to look at how they can cut costs to make the profit they need to make on these. And I think that illustration and design is often a place that's very quick to get chopped. We've seen it already in publishing back in the 90s when stock photo became much more prevalent in illustration markets where illustration was doing really well. Even if you look at music, when you looked at album covers, especially in the rock and jazz formats, albums had a lot of illustration. It was a big illustration market. When the CD came, the size changed, the format changed, and I think the thinking of what was appropriate for packaging changed. And yes, you do still see illustration on CDs and for music, but I think there's a lot less of it. And I think there were probably many, many artists who made a majority of their living, maybe some even making all of their living off of album cover art back in the 70s. And that certainly was no longer a viable market for them by the time the 80s even came, much less now. And I wonder if book cover art may be going the same way. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying I'm asking myself the questions of, if it does, what do I do? And how do I approach it? And how do I sort of stay ahead of that curve if I can? And it comes down to where that price point ends up landing. That'll help me to decide where I think this is going to go. Because I think once those publishers make those decisions, it's going to be fast. It's going to be a lot of guys having to make decisions very quickly. So let's see. I don't know.
What about comics? Is that a world you're interested in?
It is. It's where I kind of started before I was even doing book covers. I was self-publishing and writing and drawing my own little stories out of architecture school. Very much inspired by things like Sandman and independent comics. And it was very personal stuff, probably too personal now I look back at those things. But it's kind of, my first love is comics. It's where I kind of grew up, and all through my life I've always had a very close relationship with those things, up until 96 when I got my first book cover opportunity. Throughout all those years of development, comics were it for me. I thought that was where I'd end up being. And this book cover career, I've never looked back and missed comics as a viable profession, because I think I realized very quickly with book covers, one of the reasons it's so right for me is because I find myself as an artist to be a sprinter more than a marathon runner. And what I mean by that is, I think with book covers, you're jumping from project to project, and they're very varied and diverse, ideally. You know, science fiction, fantasy, and horror, those are all three realms that I'm very comfortable in, but they're very they have various strengths and weaknesses, and I like playing to all of those and bouncing between them very fast. And whereas with longer projects, which I think of as graphic novels, comics, things where there's a lot more time and work that needs to be invested from the illustration side, I look at those as marathons. Even this George R. R. Martin calendar I'm working on, I consider that a bit of a marathon in that there's a lot of work that has to be put into it. A lot of, not sequential work, but just, you know, you got 12 images you've got to do as opposed to just one. And they're all on a same theme or world. And I find maybe that I'm a little bit better, or more natural, I should say, as a sprinter. And I'm finding that I do have the capability to be a good marathon runner. But it's definitely something I've had to acquire, as opposed to being very natural at being able to go to a project, bam, hit it, nail it, move on to the next one, bam, hit it, nail it. And I'm getting better as a marathon runner because of the Elric work. And I think because of the calendar. And I think with comics, though, you've got to be a damn good marathon runner because that stuff's a lot of work, has to move very fast, and you can't miss your marks. You've got to be on as far as your deadlines and the storytelling. And I think it's a world I'd like to get to. First, I'd like to do covers, if I could, with comics, and then maybe work towards interiors. But I think if you're going to do interiors, it's got to be something I'm really in love with. And I think that comes back to maybe doing something that's more personal and maybe not quite as mainstream. You know, would I love to work on Batman? Heck yeah. I mean, of course, who wouldn't? You know, but I don't know how much I want to give up all the great sprinting I get to do with book covers and the shorter projects and invest in comics until I really feel like I'm in love with the level of investment you got to give to it. It's one thing to consume it. It's another thing to have to create it. I think I've realized that about my temperament as far as how I work. You know, I really like these fast burst projects and really pouring everything I've got into them and then moving on. You can't quite do that with comics. You got to be in it for the long haul.
It sounds like what you need is for Lou to hire Mr. Moorcock to write an Elric graphic novel, and then you could do that.
Well, I'm not going to say anything. I think you might be onto some things that are starting to percolate. Now, it's not about Mike. It's not about Mike writing something. But I think that's all I'm going to say. I mean, to put it this way, I am talking to people about doing covers. I am talking to people about where I might fit. And certainly there's some people who are seeing some natural fits. And I'm sort of seeing whether I need to investigate them right now or not. And God, I'm being so vague. But you're really, it's like if we were playing the hot cold game, you might be getting a little warmer than I'm comfortable with.
It almost sounds like I've done this before. Maybe I should be in this business. Well, while we step back a little bit here, I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your work and your style and how it's evolved. I guess we'll start since 1996 when you got your first cover. And I just want to make one comment to maybe help frame it, but you obviously go anywhere you want with this question. But I've noticed, having seen a lot of your work, and I get a lot of Pyre's books, so I have lots of your work in my house, that you really are good with the human form, and you use the human form a lot, whether it's just having a full character there or having, I'm not an artist, so I'm trying to explain this in layman's terms, but a blending effect where the character blends into a landscape, or I remember this one you did where, yes, this one here, we're looking at one with the top of the heads are like roses, and okay, here we go. Muse of Fire by Dan Simmons. That is so cool. And the big eye in the background, you know, that kind of thing. I really like that about your work. So wherever you want to go with that, I'll just let you run with this for a few minutes.
Sure. Well, I mean, as far as the human form, I mean, I've gotten that question before, and I don't know if I can answer why it is that I gravitate towards certain tropes and certain visual ideas. I've always said that I am the single worst person to define what it is stylistically that I'm about. I think I would never deny that there are certain things that I seem to return to, but I would say it is not conscious at all. I mean, it really is sort of a thing of there are certain things that just really interest me. I mean, for a while there, I could almost pinpoint like gears and certain shapes. Just I seem to see them over and over again in my work. And there were even times where I tried not to do them or not to use them, and I'd still find myself gravitating. I think sometimes those things are crutches. I think sometimes they show weakness, and I think you really do have to work to try to break beyond those. And I think I've done better over the last few years about breaking through some of that stuff. I've got a lot more of them still to break through. I've got a lot of growing still to do. But I think a lot of times, often the things that people say are your part of your style are often things that are maybe not even conscious, but also mistakes. You know, things that are maybe, I think sometimes that the mistakes that people gravitate to and think are very cool, and maybe it's not necessarily the things that the artist is trying to express or trying to present as the forward mechanisms to communicate. I find that when I read about artists that I really admire, like, say, like Dave McKean, he says, you know, I see a lot of people copying my work, but they're the things that they seem to copy are the things that I think are negatives about my work. And I think that that's a pretty insightful comment. I don't know. I know that I'm very interested in how a picture is made and how an artist makes a picture in the 21st century. I have all the respect in the world for traditional painters. I have all the respect in the world for guys who are 100% digital. I'm very interested in the combination of those two and the hybrid frontiers that are in between those two poles. And that, I think, is where I've kind of done a lot of my living. I've never been one pole or the other. I'd say I drift more toward traditional means than toward digital as far as what I appreciate and what I want out of myself. I would never be a 100% digital guy. I can pretty much say that for sure. And of course, that's going to be the thing that people look back on if I ever go completely digital and say, aha! But no, I kind of just can't see it because I really still love getting my hands dirty. And no matter how advanced iPads might become or softwares might become in how they let artists communicate and make pictures, I won't be able to get my hands dirty, I suspect. At least not in my lifetime. I don't think they're going to be able to do that. So I think I'll always want traditional materials to be part of my process. In a nutshell, what I'm doing is creating pencil drawings and painting elements that are done in the real world and then scanned or photographed and brought into a Mac using Photoshop and just very primitively overlaying and compositing these elements to make a picture. You know, and I have sketches that I do to guide me to sort of formulate where I'm trying to go. I always have an idea of the color palette I'm going for. But I do things in a very, I think, probably unusual way compared to the way most guys do things. You know, it's grayscale, oils, pencil drawings, and then the colors are done as abstract color paintings with acrylics. And they have no form. They're all about color value and palette. And then I'm taking that and overlaying it over the scale, very defined formwork.
Wow, really?
And then it's basically a big mess when you look at it. You're just like, oh, God, that just none of that marries very well together at all. But then it's a matter of taking the little bits of surprises where it's like, wow, but that really works right there. And look at that over there. That really works, too. And using those almost as anchor points, you say, okay, now that's working. Now, what if we just move this color over here and made that, make it so that it complements that value? And before you know it, here comes the jigsaw starting to work itself out. It's literally as if you threw up a bunch of, you know, a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle in the air, let the pieces land and say, okay, now these are starting to work together. Now let's use those and start to build out from there. And what it does is I think it loosens me up. It keeps me from sort of looking at things in a paint-by-numbers way. And I think that's an important thing, at least for art. I think for any art, is to not make it so completely formulaic. I think for somebody like me who's very procedural, that's very important to have that loosening up built into the process. So personally, that's why it works for me. Would it work for all artists? Probably not. But I am very interested in people like my neighbor over here in the booth, Dave Seeley, and how he combines media. You know, he's very much a traditional digital hybrid. And I'm really appreciating more and more the number of artists that I see that are combining the two. Have no problem with the poles in their very extreme pure form. But, man, I am so much more interested in what's happening in the middle.
That's fascinating to hear how you do that. I would not suspect that's how it was done. When I'm talking with writers, I've had this conversation about the difference between the terms writer and author. Writer typically kind of meaning more the, you know, working hard every day, you know, the more the job aspect of it. The author, more of the glamour part, you know, going to book events, meeting fans, that kind of idea. Someone who has written a successful novel, say. And how some people want to be authors, they don't want to be writers, right? how does this apply to your field, maybe the difference between an artist or an illustrator?
Artist is a word I put a lot of value on. I mean, I think it's almost, for me, it's like when I say somebody's an artist, it's because I feel like they've moved the chips forward for the rest of us. You know, it's not just because they can draw and paint well necessarily. It's because they've sort of offered visions to us that that we wouldn't have had without them, or they've looked at the world in a way that has changed the way the rest of us see it. And I think when you put it if those stakes are the ones that are attached to that word, that starts to cut the crop significantly, I think. For myself, I have no problem when somebody calls me an artist. In fact, I'm grateful for it. But I don't think that they necessarily have the same definition that I do, and it doesn't matter. I'm okay with it. But I sort of feel like for myself, I'm careful not to call myself an artist because I feel it's what I'm trying to work toward being. And I think it's a constant struggle and a constant journey. And I think to me, if I can be an artist, be somebody who moves the chips forward for everybody, that's going to be a thing that's going to happen over a long time. I don't even know it's up to me to decide that. And I think it's maybe a little bit pretentious for me to say that I have done that. I think it's for other people to decide, the audience, I should say, whether the course of my work has helped to, as I keep saying, move the chips forward. So I always call myself an illustrator because that's my role. That's my job that I'm doing within the big scheme. I mean, that's what I'm doing. But I always say I'm an illustrator who's trying every day to be a better artist, to be an artist, you know? So that's the way I look at it personally. So when I look at other people's work, I don't necessarily jump straight to calling them an artist until I sort of see a trajectory of their work or a body of work, you know? And so there's a lot of people out there that I think are great, but I don't know if they're necessarily artists. They're great draftsmen or great painters. Have they necessarily presented a vision that pushes me or pushes the rest of us forward? I don't know. That's the tougher one.
On the show, we've talked a lot about and with the writers and illustrators of the future, and it just popped into my head. It's funny that it's not called the authors and artists of the future. You know, they emphasize the working element of that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I never thought of that. But, I'm happy with both. I don't have a problem with either word. It's just my own personal way I look at them, and I don't ever try to correct people and say, wait a minute, no. You ask me the question of how I see them, and that's the way I see them. You know, it's up to everybody to decide how they look at it.
Awesome. Can you walk us through what the process is like when you get a phone call to do a new book? The process of finding out, yes, you're going to do this illustration for this cover. Just how the whole thing works from how you work with the publisher and how you approach it as an artist. Because I think you're an artist.
That's kind. So you get the call and... you know, you have the discussions of the details of schedule and budget and what kind of direction the client is trying to go with the piece. You know, what audience are they trying to reach? You know, so that'll be exchanged in a few quick emails and sometimes right there in that initial phone call. And usually what I'll do is try to get my hands on the manuscript or as much of the manuscript as possible right from the outset. It's hard to read everything that you do covers for. I make the best effort I can to try to read every one of them. If it's an anthology, I might ask for a selection of stories that the editor or the publishing team thinks are sort of define the overall spirit of the thing. Yeah, if it's a novel, then I'm trying to read the whole thing if I can. I haven't yet become an audiobook guy, a guy who can paint while listening to the audiobooks. I haven't quite gotten there yet. I'm still a guy who prefers to read it, do my brief, take my notes, and I'm always looking for the details of what I think is going to work for the cover. I'm always thinking with a filter of don't necessarily look for a literal solution, try to find something that's an evocative solution. In other words, I look at scenes in a book and I look at key character defining moments, but I'm not underlining them saying, I am going to illustrate these two sentences. Here it is. This is the two sentences that I will illustrate. I'm usually saying that here's the passages that I think are springboards for where I'm going to try to go. So that might probably indicates that I tend to move toward more conceptual, abstract, evocative solutions. And I think overall I would have to say that that's where a lot of my stuff seems to head toward. Why do I do it that way? I guess it's because those are the solutions that when I see covers, when I'm the audience, those are the ones that I appreciate. I think in a way for me, I feel like you respect the audience a little more because you're not saying, here's the way you're going to see this. And you pin it down and you say, this is it. Now you take it. That's it. And you don't give them any room for their imagination to wiggle and come up with and fill in the gaps and come up with their own way of seeing it. I think it's a tougher road to build in those gaps and to allow the audience in to sort of fill in the vision. Not to say that it's not great to, you know, a lot of sweat to be able to create something completely literal, but I think it's a little bit tougher, I believe, to do the evocative rather than the literal. And it's more of a challenge for me, and I therefore that's kind of the stuff I tend to head toward. So I will do sketches, sometimes some literal, some evocative, but I usually start to define things in these little thumbnails, and those will get presented to the client. They'll decide which one they like. I often will attach little notes that will say, this is why I think this one might work better. If we're trying to go towards this audience, this one might work a little bit better. And they'll make their decisions. And then from there, I'll start, building little bits of reference or shooting family and friends in with photographs or making little bits of costume. It's nothing that's ever whole and complete, but just little bits of stuff that'll help to guide me as I start to do final drawings and move toward a final solution. So it's, you're going to have these pencil and drawings that are fairly formal and where you sort of see everything there. They start off loose, but I end up with very tight pencils, and then I'll go and generally work things out in grayscale oils and then photograph or scan, set those aside, and then I'll do these abstract color paintings and overlay those things digitally via Photoshop. And I use it in a very primitive way. It's not a real, I don't spend a super amount of time in the Photoshop stage. I try not to. I think sometimes some of my stuff really gets caught up in that. And maybe sometimes I think those are the weaker pieces. I tend to find the stuff that spends a lot more time in the traditional, the stuff that I tend to gravitate toward. But I'm not ashamed of using Photoshop in this way. In fact, I revel in it because I love the surprises that overlaying gives me. So it's worth it to me. And I very much love those digital possibilities.
Now, do you send the publisher the work as you're going along? Or do you wait until you have a final product and then you send it?
That depends on schedule and budget. I think in general, though, I would say there's usually an intermediate, at least one intermediate between sketches and final, where I'm sort of showing them, okay, this is kind of how things are shaping up. Sometimes you just go literally from sketch to final, But usually there's at least one intermediate stage in there.
Who are some of your favorite writers?
Writers? Well, as soon as you say the word, Jeffrey Ford comes to mind. Jeff Ford is a guy I've done a few covers for, and he's the kind of writer who, if I wasn't in the business, I'd be just a gargantuan fan of his anyway. And as I've gotten to sort of know people in the business, he's also one of those guys who I really find to be one of my favorite human beings in the business. And I enjoy his work a lot. I mean, I've never read anything bad by Jeff. Michael Moorcock's another one that I just think he's a giant, and I love his work. Paolo Bacigalupi, I think he's terrific, although I've never done anything by him. I've always had an affection for Jorge Luis Borges, and I always thought, God, it would be fun to do a cover for Dream Tigers or for a definitive Jorge Luis Borges collection. I don't know. Those are the ones that just popped in my head right now. I'm sure once we stop this, I'm like, oh, I should have thought of that guy. But those are the ones that just popped up.
I was just about to say that. 2006, Monkey Brain Books published a collection about you and your work. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that came together and where the listeners can find that? And I'll link to it from Amazon. I assume it's on Amazon.
Well, the book actually is now out of print. It was about, there was 2,000 copies printed. It was Monkey Brain Books. And how it came about is Chris Robertson and Allison Baker, who run Monkey Brain, are very good friends of mine. And we were at a convention and just kind of said, you know, I think I brought it to them and said, hey, would you guys have room on your publishing schedule at any point for me to have an art book that might come out through your publishing company? And I was sort of at that time saying, if it were to come out, no matter what publisher it came out through, I'd kind of like to design it myself. And that equation seemed to fit pretty well. They sort of thought, well, we don't know anything about art books or how to distribute, market, or put one together. So if you're actually designing it, then maybe we can figure out the other end of it. So, you know, at the time, I think it was a really nice collection of my stuff. And in a way, it sort of, I guess my career started with the first book cover in 96. That book came out in 2006. So in a way, it was like a nice 10-year container of my that first decade's worth of work. And it wasn't intended that way, but it worked out that way. And I sort of saw that book as a way to sort of exercise some of the frustrations I have with art books, where they just always seem to be a collection of pictures with some analysis. And I thought, you know, I want to see what's, I want to hear what's in a guy's head, or what, I want to see what was their problem solving about. You know, not just about the brushes and the color combinations, or even the historical context. I want to hear why they made the decisions they did when they put that picture together. And especially if the guy's living, or the he or she is living, I'd like to know a little bit about what was in their head. And so I tried to give that and put my money where my mouth was, and sort of think, if I was trying to break into the business, for somebody who's trying to take my job, what would be the best things I could give them to take away my job? It's a strange way to look at it, but that is the kind of the way I attacked that book. As I sort of said, here's some things I would pass on, and what I wish I would have known if I was breaking into the business. So I the book came out, and as of this point, it's hard to find copies, I would say. Yeah.
Well, I got one right here. Maybe I'll just take it. well, that leads into my final question I was going to ask you, which is, what advice do you have for people who want to steal your job?
I would say just work, work, work. But I would say, to give something specific, beyond just the, you know, give it everything you got and, you know, try to build your own personal vision, etc. I think one thing I've sort of seen and learned is that I see these two different tracks of thinking, where, with book covers specifically, where you'll have artists who will say, well, I'm here to serve the client and to make sure that this book sells and sells the most copies possible, and that's the most important thing. Everything beneath that is secondary. And there's another track of thinking that says, I want to do what I think has the most integrity, speaks the best to the content that's within this book, and I want to do something that's true, and I want something to be of a strong personal artistic vision. And so you have these two tracks of thinking, and I find them to be where I find there's an exclusivity where people sort of think they're independent of each other and they run parallel. And I found that, oh my gosh, the artists that I respect the most, if I look at their work, they're always the ones that are looking for the intersection point of those. They never think of them as parallel. They see them as intersecting at some point. And it's finding that intersection point, I think, is the key, is taking what you think are the things that are going to serve the client's agendas the best, and also serving the story's agendas the best, and marrying those two together and finding that intersection point. When you find that, you nailed it. You got it. And that's the fun stuff. That's the challenge. And all the obstacles that you have to go through and jump over and get under and move around to get to that intersection point. If you can't get down with that, then you're probably not right for this. But if you do, then this is the love of your life.
Awesome. Well, John, it's been awesome having you on the show. Is there anything else you wanted to mention before we sign off?
No, it's been a pleasure. I've always heard about this show, and I'm glad we got to get together. As far as just current stuff that I'm working on, just finished turning in the cover for Elric Swords and Roses that comes out from Del Rey in December. Finished a Sherry Tepper cover for HarperCollins. And working on several covers right now, but the big project right now, the one that's really staring me in the face is the 2012 calendar for George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire that'll come out from Bantam. So I'm pouring my heart and soul into it, and we'll see how it all comes out in the end.
And you said 2012?
It's 2012. It was originally going to be the 2011, but because of the HBO show and sort of the fervor to take advantage of the buzz of that, I think they decided to move up some of the deadlines. So they said, we're going to move your work to 2012 and take some work that we had in inventory from Ted Naismith that's of a more architectural variety, these castle paintings that he did are just they're amazing pieces of work. But those were, I think, already in inventory. They sort of already had them. And they said, you know, we're going to move that and make that the 2011 calendar, and yours will be the 2012 to give you more time to finish off your stuff. Because they moved up some deadlines a little bit because of the show. Or because there was show news starting to percolate, and they wanted to take advantage of it. I think specifically for San Diego Comic-Con, honestly. I think that 2011 calendar actually may be floating around on the floor already. But mine will be, if I'm guessing correctly, probably out at this time next year. July 2011, the 2012 calendar should probably start to rear its head.
Look for it at Comic-Con next year then. And if, folks, if you haven't seen John's work, johnpicacio.com is the website. Use the link in the show notes. And if it's okay with you, John, we'll link to some of your artwork on the website too. All right, John has been our guest. It's been great having you on. And we will be back. Stranded in space, spinning out of control, and on a collision course with the sun, the crew of the spacecraft Corvus is about to discover something that will shatter everything they hold dear, and call into question everyone they trust. Murder. From Stephen Ewan Cobb, Parsec Award-winning producer of the Future and You podcast, comes a science fiction thriller that will make you question everything. Find Bones Burnt Black at your favorite online retailer or at your local bookstore. And visit the author's website at stevecobb.com. Bones Burnt Black by Stephen Ewan Cobb. If space doesn't kill you, someone you trust will. Up on the website this week, you will find part three of M.K. Hobson's historical fantasy series. As you know, she did a three-part series on our website this month. And part three, The Future, Historical Fantasy, The Future, is now available. And she kind of looks where historical fantasy is going over the next few years. So I want to thank Mary for bringing such great content to the website. I hope those of you who went there and enjoyed it. If you haven't, I certainly encourage you to do it. You can't miss it. There's a big feature image on the website for you to click on. So you can read the articles right from there. And I wish Mary all the best with Native Star. If you haven't read our review of Native Star, Mary's new historical fantasy novel, come check it out. It looks like a very good book. I haven't read it myself, but I did pick it up and start it in Borders. And it starts very well. Mary's an excellent writer, and I look forward to having her on the show sometime and to having more books from her in the future. Speaking of books, let's go ahead and look at some of the things that have come in. Since the podcast, since 2.0, has gotten some good traction here, more books are starting to come in. And, you know, we can't feature all these authors on the show. It's just impossible. But the least I can do is tell you about some of the books. And if you didn't know, if you go to the website, you'll see a link, and it's just called Books. And once a month, I go ahead and I post everything that has come into my house. I put the cover image on there, a description of the book. So if you're looking for something to read and, you know, you just don't know where to go, it happens to all of us at some point, come check out that section, and you'll have plenty of things to look at. The first one here is called Yarn This is the follow-up to Gray, written by John Armstrong. It will be published by Nightshade Books, who just published Paulo's Hugo Award-winning novel. They do excellent stuff over there at Nightshade. And if you haven't read Gray, you can listen to the interview I did with John. It's in the archives. Oh, I want to say it's in the 40s, episode 44, 45, something like that. Gray is also available as a free Podio book. I think it's on podiobooks.com, and I certainly encourage you to do that. It is rated R, so be warned. Here's the description of this. In a future obsessed with fashion, shopping, and celebrity, Tane Cedar is the master tailor, the supreme outfitter of the wealthy, the beautiful, and the powerful, tasked with creating a coat of, I don't know how to pronounce that, XI, I don't know, an illegal and dangerous drug-infused fiber. By his former ex-lover, Tane must delve deep into the patterns of his past, unraveling the knit of the present. Armed with his yarn pool, scissors, oh man, their names on here I can't pronounce. Anyway, from the neo-feudalistic slums and cornfields of Tane's youth of his apprenticeship among the sales warriors of Seattle, Ohama, sex and shopping capital of the world, yarn takes its readers through Tane's mercenary adolescence spent ripping threads from the garments of celebrities, learning the soft and ply of fabric to the obsidian and gold towers of his ascendancy and beyond. So this doesn't look like it's a direct follow-up to Gray, but John Armstrong returns to the high fashion dystopia first glimpsed in Gray, weaving a stylish and scintillating tale of past and present colliding. Interesting stuff. John's a good guy. He's a good man. He's good enough to have me on his podcast. He's a good writer. So even though I haven't read this yet, it's one I'm looking forward to. Yarn, forthcoming from Nightshade Books. Let's see. Does it have a publication date on here? Sometimes they tell you on here on these arcs when they're going to be published, but I don't see it on this one. But you can be sure I will let you know. We also have a couple books here from Pyre. Let's see here. Tome of the Undergates by Sam Sykes. Sam is going to be on the show, and this novel is going to be sponsoring the show pretty soon here. This is an adventure fantasy, and the first term in the description is adventurer. So if you're looking for something action-packed, lots of adventure, Tome of the Undergates, the Eon's Gate Book 1. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I'm terrible with my pronunciations. Wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable. So I'm looking forward to this one as well. This is a bigger one if you want something a little meatier to read. Here's a fascinating one. This is also from Pyre. Spring-Heeled Jack by Mark Hodder. The cover of this novel is awesome. And they kind of did it. The whole package of this book is kind of like, very Victorian something. Like it looks like a ticket to a very fancy show or something like that, and the artwork is spectacular. Who does this artwork? I'm going to put this image on the website. Let's see here. Cover illustration by John Sullivan. Well done, John Sullivan. I find it fascinating. There's a story going on here. Kind of Sherlock Holmes meets steampunk meets cyberpunk. I mean, I don't even know how to describe that. But this is definitely one to check out. Sir Richard Francis Burton, an explorer and linguist, a scholar and a swordsman. His reputation tarnished, his career in tatters, his former partner missing and probably dead. When one man changes history, history changes everyone. This one looks very good. High praise on here from Michael Moorcock. Looks like it takes place in London, 1861. That's Spring-Heeled Jack, The Strange Affair. Spring-Heeled Jack from Mark Hodder. Excellent stuff. I think I have one more from Pyre here. Jasper Kent, 12, Russia, 1812. It began as a vast stand against Napoleon's invading army. It would end as a fight against an enemy of mankind itself. And that is a rather violent looking cover on there. Yeah, I'll read this from the back of the book here. As his face came close to mine, the sudden miasma surrounded me, the stench of his breath. I recalled years ago standing over a mass grave where the bodies of brave soldiers had been lying for many days. It was the same odor of decay, and I felt the same urge to run as I had then, accompanied by an even deeper sense of dread that I could not place. Full of historical detail, thrilling action, and heart-stopping supernatural moments, 12 is storytelling at its most original and exciting. This looks like it would have fit well into the historical fantasy analysis that M.K. Hobson just did for us. 12 by Jasper Kent, also out from Pyre. Just a couple more here. I got a couple Stargate SG-1 novels. If you didn't know, I write for GateWorld.net, the internet's leading Stargate website. And I do author interviews over there. We have one coming out. Might have been posted today, but definitely by Monday or Tuesday. And then this one here is Four Dragons, and I'm going to be interviewing Diana about Four Dragons. So if you like Stargate, make sure you're checking those out. Ken Scholes is back with book three of his fantasy series, which started with Lamentation and is definitely a book I recommend. Book two was Canticle, and this is, I guess you would pronounce it, Antiphon. And, you know, these are good books. They're a little bit different. They're shorter, which is nice. They're only around 300, 350 pages. I prefer that over the 800,000 page tomes that sometimes come out of epic fantasy. Love you, Brandon. But this continues the Psalm of Isaac series. And it's cool. It kind of has a gypsy feel to it. You can magic yourself. You can disguise yourself using magics. And there's always a consequence to the magics. They'll make you sick, especially if you're not used to them. So it's an interesting world there. Book two got a little bit darker than book one was, but I'm enjoying this series, and I definitely recommend, if you're looking for something good, to check out Lamentation, and this is book three, just out from Tor, by Ken Scholes. All right, one more for you. This one is weird, okay? The front cover is a hand, and someone's written on the hand in ink, John Dies at the End, okay? That's the title of the book, John Dies at the End. But if you open up the entire jacket, you see that it's not just a hand, it's a severed arm, and you can see where it's severed on the back cover. It certainly gets your attention, and I want to read this to you from the back. My name is David Wong, my best friend is John. These names are fake. You might want to change yours. You may not want to know about the things you'll read on these pages, about the sauce, about Karak, about the invasion and the future, but it's too late. You touched the book. You're in the game. You're under the eye. The only defense is knowledge. You need to read this book to the end, even the part with the bratwurst. Why? You just have to trust me. The important thing is this. The drug is called soy sauce, and it gives users a window into another dimension. John and I never had the chance to say no. You still do. Unfortunately for us, if you make the right choice, we'll have a much harder time explaining how to fight off the otherworldly invasion currently threatening to enslave humanity. I'm sorry to involve you in this, I really am, but as you read about these terrible events and the very dark epoch the world is about to enter as a result, it is crucial you keep one thing in mind. None of this is my fault. So definitely something with some humor here. John dies at the end. It promises to be bloody, I would guess, based on the cover art alone. So there you have it. More options will be put up in the book section. It would just take too long to go through them all, but that's a sizable chunk of what has come in to my home as of late. And I think that's going to do it for this episode. I need to go ahead and sign off and go watch the 49ers. Oh, I hope they don't go 0-3. But anyway, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Locus Magazine, for bringing this episode to our audience. LocusMag.com, AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com. Use the Locus image, please, to learn more. Next week is episode 100, and the episode is going to be a little bit longer than usual, not obscenely long, just a little bit bigger, and we do have a special guest. Everything is already recorded for this show. The only thing I have to do is edit it and put it all together, so I'll be doing that this week, and I'm looking forward to being in triple digits. Took me longer than I hoped to get there, but the important thing is I got there. I don't think I would have gotten there, though, without the help of the new crew. So I want to just send out a big thank you to Moses, Brenda, Matt, Brent, Steven, for infusing the efforts that I had already laid forth with vast amounts of energy. The content and the spirit that you have been providing this podcast since 2.0 launched has made a huge difference, and the show, you know, probably wouldn't, I may have pushed myself through to 100, but probably not beyond without you guys. And who knows, maybe another 100 lay ahead. So thank you very much, guys. And thank you for those of you in the audience who have been listening incredibly for 4 years now. That's something else. And I know I'm very honored by that. Okay, enough of the sappy stuff. I'll see you next time with special guests in episode 100. And until then, keep reading. Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, book reviews, film reviews, videos, coverage of live events, and so much more. You can leave us feedback at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com or call the voicemail line at 206-350-5029. All contact information can be found on the About Us page on the website. Until next time, keep reading.